Good morning and welcome to Central Standard Friday. I'm Monroe Dodd. The American story is about people, of course, and events and politicians and institutions. But in the end, the important aspect of the story is what makes people do what they do. One way to tell that is through economics. Now, the study of economics, we've heard, can be dismal, but in the hands of a skilled author and thinker, it can open our eyes to where we've been as a people and why we've done what we've done. Our guest today has written a book about the economic history of America that uses vignettes and arguments to paint a broad and intriguing portrait. It's a version that's new and insightful and looks not only back but also ahead. He's Michael Lind, co-founder of the New America Foundation and policy director of its Economic Growth Program. He is the author of Land of Promise, An Economic History of the United States, published last year by Harper and now out in paperback. He joins us from NPR Studios in Washington. Michael, welcome to Central Standard Friday.
Glad to be here.
Now, in your book, you name two streams in American economic history. You don't line them up as liberal or conservative, nor Democrat and Republican. You line them up with Alexander Hamilton and Thomas Jefferson. Describe those two streams, if you would.
Well, Hamilton was the first Secretary of the Treasury in the administration of George Washington, the first president, in which Thomas Jefferson also served as the first Secretary of State. The two men hated each other cordially and formed rival parties, much to the distress of Washington, who was trying to lead a national unity government in Land of Promise. I argue that these two broad traditions, the Hamiltonian and the Jeffersonian, really are deeper than some of the other categories we use today, like liberal or conservative or pro-government or pro-market. The Hamiltonian version of American capitalism I describe as developmental capitalism. It sees the government and business, and in some cases, not always, organized labor, as part of a common enterprise in developing the human and industrial resources of the nation, often through a collaboration between big government and big business. The Jeffersonian tradition has been described by historians, including myself, as a producerism. The idea is that the purpose of economics should be to create a society of small producers, small farmers, small merchants, retailers, small craftsmen. The Jeffersonian tradition, like the Hamiltonian tradition, does not believe in laissez-faire or just letting the market do its work. Both of these traditions want to intervene in the market for different purposes. The Hamiltonians have favored things like import substitution tariffs to help promote American industries against foreign competitors. The Jeffersonians have favored antitrust policies to protect small businesses and other small producers from the power of big concentrated industries and finance.
Now, Michael, as your book... I'm sorry.
Yeah, go ahead.
As your book unfolds, you talk about some things through history and some adherents of each of those traditions that might prove surprising to us and even surprising to them if they were categorized that way.
Well, particularly in the 20th century, the Hamiltonian impulse, that is, of using the federal government as an agent of modernization, took place under the auspices of Franklin Roosevelt and other Democrats who, ironically, had traditionally been the Jeffersonian Party, particularly in the South and the West. So there's a certain amount of amnesia in the case of the Democrats about where their tradition comes from. In the case of Abraham Lincoln and the mid-century Republicans who brought the Union to victory in the Civil War and then rebuilt it during Reconstruction, there was much more of a conscious sense of a tradition that extended from Alexander Hamilton and also George Washington, who almost always sided with Hamilton against Jefferson, through Henry Clay, great Kentucky senator, mm-hmm. Who carried on the Hamiltonian nation-building tradition through Abraham Lincoln himself.
Now, you write that Andrew Jackson was about as pure an example of Jeffersonianism as there can be in the White House. Now, there's an equestrian statue of Jackson here in downtown Kansas City in front of the Jackson County Courthouse. It was put there in the 1930s, courtesy of a county judge named Harry S. Truman, who was an admirer of Jackson. Isn't Jackson symbolic of a feeling that runs through many Midwesterners and Southerners of the value of the individual and perhaps even the free market?
Well, the Midwest has always been divided. It's been kind of a battleground between the North and the South, and obviously Kansas, bleeding Kansas in the decade before the Civil War. You had both Southerners and people from parts of the North battling over who would control it. If you look at Abraham Lincoln's own state of Illinois, the southern part was largely settled by border state Scots-Irish with typically Jacksonian-Jeffersonian perspectives. Interestingly, Lincoln was a Southerner. He's born in Kentucky, came from a Southern background. He used to make fun of the pretensions of the Virginians by saying that he descended from one of the second families of Virginia. But he like Washington and Clay, all three of them were Southerners. They sided with what was generally the Northern Party, that is, the party that supported the Hamiltonian agenda of government-backed industry and infrastructure. And they did so because they saw that as the main way that the South and the Midwest could develop. And if you contrast the alternate fates of the Midwest and of the Deep South during and after the Civil War, then, you know, you really see a test case of this Hamiltonian tradition in action versus the purest, most reactionary form of Jeffersonianism in the Deep South.
And Harry S. Truman, who put the statue of Andrew Jackson on the courthouse lawn in Kansas City, would, of course, go on to become president, and he basically followed up on the policies of FDR. The New Deal became the Fair Deal, and you've already said that that sort of still puts him in the Hamiltonian tradition, despite his...
Despite himself, you know, his mother refused to sleep in the Lincoln bedroom when she visited the White House. She preferred Jefferson Davis. But it is true that, effectively with FDR, the Hamiltonian tradition, which until that time in the 20th century had been identified with the progressive wing of the Republicans, led by Franklin Roosevelt's cousin and role model, Theodore Roosevelt, it was defeated within the Republican Party itself under Hoover and Coolidge and Harding. And a lot of those progressive Republicans moved into the Democratic Party and are still moving into it. If you look at the two parties, the geographic base of the Democrats now is pretty much what was the Lincoln to Hoover Republicans. It's the Northeast and parts of the Midwest. The Deep South, which was always the Jeffersonian-Jacksonian Democrats' heartland, is now the base of the GOP, and the Midwest, as it has been throughout history, is kind of a divided political battleground.
Michael Lind, your book Land of Promise does what I think is an outstanding job of giving kind of a bird's eye view or macro view of the history of America through economics. In addition to finding these two strains, the Alexander Hamilton strain, the Thomas Jefferson strain, you have also been able to divide American history into basically three parts, which you call republics.
Well, let me explain that. We pretend that we're still living under exactly the same Constitution that was hammered out in Philadelphia in 1787 and went into effect in 1789. The French are much more honest than we are. They've had five republics since the French Revolution in 1789, several empires, a directorate, and even a fascist dictatorship, the Vichy regime during World War II. Mm-hmm. And there's a joke about an American who goes to Paris and asks for a copy of the latest French Constitution. And the bookseller sniffs at him and says, "We do not sell periodical literature." What I argue, and a number of historians have made similar points, although they don't necessarily agree with my categorization, in effect, we've had three different regimes, even though formally it's under the same constitution. The first was created in the 1790s, and then it collapsed during the Civil War. The second was rebuilt, the Second Republic of the United States, under Abraham Lincoln and his successors. And that fell apart during the Great Depression. And Roosevelt and his successors, including so-called modern Republicans like Eisenhower and Nixon, who accepted much of the New Deal, created the Third Republic, in which I argue we're living today, although it may be falling apart around us. So these are kind of informal regimes. So even though we don't have new paper money and, you know, we don't change the location of the capital or the name of the country, I argue that, you know, we really have had just as much change in this country as other nations where they've had formal revolutions.
You're listening to Central Standard Friday on KCUR. I'm Munro Dodd. Today our guest is Michael Lind, author of Land of Promise, An Economic History of the United States. Michael, you tie the beginning of each of these three American republics to a catastrophe or a major disruption in history. And then you talk about how technology ties in or doesn't always tie in with that catastrophe.
Well, one of my purposes in writing Land of Promise was to try to tease out the relationship between technological progress and political change. You have histories of technology with Edison and James Watt and Henry Ford on the one hand, and then there are political histories, but these two tend not to be integrated. And after studying this for many years, I concluded that there's kind of a time lag in American politics, not only in the U.S., I'm sure you can find this in other societies as well. The laws and institutions of any given era tend to presuppose a particular kind of society and economy based on a particular kind of technology. When the society is transformed by new technology, when you go from the agrarian era in the United States in the late 18th century to the early industrial era based on steam-powered factories and steam locomotives, then you get all sorts of radical changes. And it begins in the economy, but it filters into society as well. But it runs up against the barrier that the laws and political institutions were all designed for an earlier, now disappearing America. And the gap between the emerging technology-driven society and the increasingly archaic political system tends to build up until there's a crisis. And the crisis is not caused by technology. It could be a civil war. It can be a depression. But that gives a generation of leaders the opportunity to put through what in many cases had been modernizing reforms that were simply blocked during the more peaceful era before the crisis.
And you say we may be in a situation like that now, where our institutions and our policies have not caught up with technology.
Well, the reason I think that is the last major overhaul of America's economic system, its laws involving business, labor, social insurance, really was the New Deal era between the 1930s, and then it kind of culminated with Lyndon Johnson's Great Society in the mid-1960s. Since then, both Democrats and Republicans have either tried to repeal it, as many on the right have tried to do, or they've just tinkered with it and tweaked with it. The problem is that although the New Deal system was very successful for a society in which a third of the people were farmers and a third of them were factory workers, it really is increasingly anachronistic in an America where 80% of workers are in the non-traded domestic service sector. There are fewer and fewer farmers and factory workers, mainly because of technology, not because of outsourcing. Labor unions, which flourished in the concentrated industrial sector, are of diminishing relevance since you have this very large non-unionized workforce. The defined benefit pension, employer pensions, that were very important in the 50s and 60s has gone. It doesn't really have an adequate replacement because there are all kinds of deep problems with 401ks. So, you just look around the landscape, and successful reforms, which did create a mass middle class during and after World War II and all the way up to the 60s and 70s, these are kind of anachronistic in the 21st century. So the old liberalism is 40, 50, 60 years out of date. Conservatives have really had nothing to offer and still have nothing to offer, in my opinion, except for just deregulate everything and dismantle government. And somehow the market will magically, create all of these goods of individual economic security and high wages. Hmm. So it's an intellectual crisis, I think, we're facing, as well as an economic crisis.
Let's turn the binoculars around to maybe it's a poorly put figure of speech, but if we may for a second too, and look at how technological process and the American republics have affected us out here, not just in Kansas City, but in what was in the post-Civil War era, the American West. I sometimes think that like the American colonies were for Britain and like the American South, as you write, for the textile mills of New and Old England, Kansas City and the West were a resource back in the 19th century for the financial capitals of the East. Does that sound right?
Well, that's right. Although before the Civil War, the Midwest was also a resource colony for the Southern slave owner class because they wanted the Midwest to specialize, particularly in corn production, in order to feed their slave workforce so that they could use more land for cotton agriculture. Instead of raising food for their enslaved workforce. But it is definitely the case that after the Civil War, alliance in the North had joined the merchants and industrialists and bankers of the Northeast with the free farmers, many of them quite Jacksonian in their attitudes, who resented the slave-owning upper class of the South. After the Civil War, that alliance tended to break down, and thus you get the great battles between Midwesterners like William Jennings Bryan
mm-hmm.
and the Agrarian Revolt. And the Midwesterners, as did many Southerners, saw themselves, not inaccurately, as being assigned the role of a resource colony for the factories and financiers of the Northeast, which is one reason why the New Deal, when it came about through the Jeffersonian Democratic Party. It was largely a farmer-labor coalition to share some of the gains of industrial growth, which had been very concentrated among the industrial capitalists and elite professionals up until the 1930s.
Kansas City and the whole wave of Western cities, I think you can throw in Minneapolis and Omaha and others, came into being hand in hand with the technological triumph of the first big industry in America. That's what you call it, and it sounds right. The railroad systems.
That's right. Whether you had the railroad linking your town to major cities like Chicago and major export markets, really made you or broke you as a community in much of the 19th century. It's kind of like having an airport in more recent times. And a lot of communities that lost, or were not on the rail just withered away. The point I'm making in the book about the railroad is we tend to think of the second half of the 19th century as the Gilded Age, the age of big business. But really the giant industrial corporations, if you think of, meatpacking and Standard and Oil those classic robber baron companies, they formed fairly late in the 1880s and 1890s. There was this very odd period, which we don't remember very well, from about the 1840s up until the 1880s, where really most businesses in the U.S., including most manufacturing businesses, were pretty small. And there was just one giant industry, and it was the railroads. And the politicians in both parties worked for it. It was kind of like the U.S. was sort of like a third world country at that point where there was just the one business, let's say the oil industry is the dominant industry. And that created, enormous corruption as having a one industry town or state or even a one industry country tends to do.
Mm-hmm. I know that in the Kansas City's first years of having a business class that was go-getters, which was right after the Kansas-Nebraska Act in the 1850s, the first aim of those guys when they got together and they laid their plan, these were real estate investors or whatever, it was to get a railroad in town. They tried to create one themselves. They chartered several. Nothing went. So you had to go east to get those people to say, I'll put a railroad there. I'll put a bridge across the Missouri. I'll do all these things. That was the obsession throughout the 1850s and up to the end of the Civil War.
Yeah, and while the federal government played a kind of supplementary role, for example, by providing land grants for the Transcontinental Railroad, for the most part, it was driven by boosters, by local chambers of commerce and local developers in particular cities and counties and states. And that created enormous problems because there was no coordination. And so again and again and again, you would have one city would decide it's going to have the railroad go through it, and then its neighboring city charters its own railroad. And you ended up with enormous overcapacity with all of these bits and pieces of railroad networks, so that by around 1900, around a quarter of railroads were in bankruptcy perpetually in the United States. Other countries escaped this, but by the quite un-American method of just having more centralized government planning on the theory that railroad networks, like road networks, are sort of natural monopolies with benefits of scale, and you really should just have one either public or publicly regulated network. But that was not the American system. It was very locally driven to promote local commerce.
And the reason these railroads went bankrupt is they had such a big investment in infrastructure. Is that right?
Yeah, the railroad industry, it does not correspond to everything they teach you in Econ 101. There are some industries with deeply sunk costs, like factories and railroads, where the profit you make has to pay off the people you borrowed the money from to build it, in addition to paying the operating expenses. What that means is if you get two parallel railroads side by side competing for the same traffic and they have a price-cutting war, as strange as it sounds, both of the railroads can go bankrupt simultaneously. And this happened again and again in the late 19th century. And it was one of the reasons that we developed in the United States the idea of public utility commissions as an alternative to what other countries did with these industries, which was simply to nationalize them. The American version of nationalizing or socializing, these natural monopolies, as many economists describe them, was to let them remain in private hands, but you would create nonpartisan commissions with citizens and with representatives of business and sometimes labor to determine things like the routes and the rates. And the U.S. never really got it right with railroads, because it was by the time this was worked out in the early 20th century, trucking and passenger traffic by car was already killing the railroads. And so it's been a sick industry, really, from the early 20th century to the 21st. Right now, it's revived mainly because railroad in the U.S. is almost entirely devoted to freight transportation, which is one of the obstacles to the vision of high-speed passenger rail, because that's essentially reversing the whole trend, where passenger traffic has gone through intercity passenger traffic through buses or through air travel, rather than passenger rail. If you look at Europe, it's the opposite. European freight depends much more on trucking, and therefore the rails are free to be used by passenger rail, but there's sort of a trade-off.
I was riding Amtrak Southwest Limited once, and the train simply stopped, and I asked a conductor eventually, why are we stopped? And he said, because there's a freight train that's got priority over us. After all, it's their railroad.
I took Amtrak through Pennsylvania one time, and it kept breaking down, and it got slower and slower and slower with every city, and finally it got to Lancaster, Pennsylvania. And a clan of about 20 German-speaking Amish got on. And I thought, this form of transportation is so primitive that even the Amish are allowed to use Amtrak. It doesn't violate their prohibition against advanced technology.
Okay, under their code. Wow. If Kansas City, what do you think is the most important part of America's economic history? You can join our conversation by calling 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Facebook is also an option. Our Twitter handle is KCURCST, and you can email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. You mentioned, Michael, the some other things that basically today we call utilities that were granted franchises. Commissions were set up, and they essentially were granted a sanctioned monopoly, like natural gas, electricity, and for a while even telephones.
Yeah, it was called price and entry regulation. In order to get a charter, you had to agree to be governed by one of these utility commissions. And there was a great wave of deregulation, which actually started under Carter. Mm-hmm. There was a consensus by both Democrats and Republicans that some of this needed to be deregulated. And arguably, deregulation succeeded in some industries but not in others. For example, in trucking, there was really never any reason to regulate trucking in the first place. It wasn't one of these natural monopoly industries like the railroads. There were no network effects or returns to scale. A small trucking company was as competitive with a big one. Airlines, the question is still unresolved. A lot of people thought that if you got rid of the regulation of airlines and when we abolished the Civil Aeronautics Board, which was the regulatory agency in the Carter years, what you would get is predatory monopolies, because these things, it's not that the planes are the key cost, it's actually control of the routes. And what has happened is, once you got rid of regulation, you've had a number of airlines with these fortress hubs where they try to route everybody through the hubs to cross-subsidize long-distance travel, and mergers as well. So I think the initial reaction to deregulation in the 1980s and 1990s, that this was a good thing in all ways, I think people have to reconsider this, particularly with airlines. It's not clear, by the way, that it really makes sense to have multiple competitive small airlines instead of one or two big monopolies or oligopolies. And if it's a natural monopoly or oligopoly industry, that's an oligopoly is where you have several big companies. Then the question is, do you try to break them up into little small pieces that compete with each other, or do you just accept that there are efficiencies arising from scale and you just try to govern their behavior so they don't exploit their power?
We have a caller. Let's go down to Bill in Brookside. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning. I appreciate the information I'm learning from you today. There's a couple of things I think that had a huge impact on our economic growth in the United States. One is we had unlimited cheap labor, whether it was slaves or immigrants. we had a constant flow of people who were willing to work for very low wages. Secondly, is we had unlimited natural resources in the United States. It was only a recent phenomenon where we came across a situation where we talk about limited resources. Our industrial complex was built on unlimited cheap resources and unlimited cheap labor. I'd like to hear your comments on that.
Well, I think that's a very accurate description. And if you include land and resources, of course, the federal government owned much of the land and either gave it away or sold it. So if you look at countries that are now trying to catch up with the U.S., like China, they're relying on the same thing, on cheap labor, which they suppress politically, you know, by being a dictatorship that outlaws unions and keeps wages low, and also subsidies of cheap or free land, electricity, water, and so on to companies, whether they're native or foreign. You can make the case that while this helped the U.S. catch up very rapidly to Britain, which was its model, the first industrial nation, by the early 20th century, it's actually hurt us as a 21st century economy, because the countries like Germany, for example, which caught up without having those advantages in the 19th century, they did not have cheap land, they did not have a frontier, they did not have cheap labor either. They had a very influential, skilled craftsman workforce. The same is true of Japan, which also caught up around the same time the United States was industrializing. Their systems rely much more on high wages, on retraining their own workers, on using resources efficiently. So I think your caller is right, but I'm afraid we were kind of spoiled because the way we did it in kind of a slipshod way.
But part of Germany's growth also had a lot of influx of government policies and regulations, much more than the United States did.
Well, that's true, but you shouldn't underestimate how interventionist the U.S. government was between the Civil War and the Great Depression. It's true that there wasn't a big welfare state, you know, like Social Security and Medicare, but the U.S. government had the highest tariffs in the world between the Civil War and 1945 in order to protect American industry. We had an extremely sophisticated industrial policy in which we had high tariffs on manufactured goods that would hurt American industrialists. But we had very low tariffs on raw materials to create kind of a seller's market for industrial goods and a buyer's market for, you know, cheap raw materials from Latin America. So we did have a very sophisticated industrial policy. It just wasn't very worker-friendly.
Bill in Brookside, thanks so much for your call. Michael Lind, we'll be back with you after the break to talk more about America's pluck and its luck through the years in inventing and reinventing itself. You're listening to Central Standard Friday on KCUR. Welcome back to Central Standard Friday. I'm Munro Dodd. Today, we're talking about ourselves, our country, our world as we struggle out of the Great Recession. Our guest, author Michael Lind, is author of Land of Promise, An Economic History of the United States. He's a co-founder of the New America Foundation, and he writes often for Salon.com, the Financial Times, and the New York Times. You can join our conversation about history, about the economy, by calling us at 816-235-2888. Or email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. We're also on Facebook, and our Twitter handle, they'll say that three times fast, is KCURCST. Michael, you were saying earlier about free land, and that's part of our growth here in the central part of the country that sometimes we forget about, the Homestead Act and even the Morrill Land Grant Act that brought goods to us.
Yeah, that's right. And, of course, before it was free, it was stolen from the American Indians at gunpoint, you know, and you know, the French and particularly areas that were part of the Louisiana Purchase and the Spanish Crown had already, but essentially, as in Australia, as in much of Latin America, you had European colonists, you know, sweeping these Aboriginal people off the land, and you know, it was an enormous benefit. It was even involved in having relatively high wages in the U.S. compared to Europe, because when wages fell too far in Philadelphia or New York or other eastern cities, then some of the workers would decide to become farmers, and they would move west. Even before the Homestead Act, during the Lincoln years, created a massive federal program to promote small farmers. And the early labor movement in the United States always favored a Homestead Act because it thought that created tight labor markets in the cities back east by draining off the surplus workforce and raising wages.
And then you also mentioned in your book the Land Grant Act for colleges, which we sometimes forget, but it brought an awful lot of expertise and technology out here to the hinterlands.
Well, the Morrill Land Grant Act, named after Justin Morrill of Vermont, was signed into law by President Lincoln during the Civil War. It fulfilled what had been one of the dreams of George Washington, who had hoped to get Congress unsuccessfully to found a kind of national research institution that would apply scientific methods to agriculture, the biggest and most important American industry, all the way up into the late 19th century. The Morrill Land Grant Act gave federal land grants to subsidize A&Ms, agricultural and mechanical colleges. A later act in the 1880s, the Hatch Act, was arguably even more important because it created a system of federally funded A&M research institutions and programs on modernizing agriculture, the results of which were then shared through county extension agents to farmers to upgrade the productivity of the farming sector. And as farming became more productive, then you could grow much more food with fewer farmers and more technology, and that shed labor to other growing sectors such as industry. So it affected the entire economy, not just agriculture.
And what we saw here in the Central Plains, through the especially through the middle of the 20th century, was a diminishing number of people in the little towns and in the farms because of those very advances. You could grow more with fewer people.
Well, this is continuing, and of course, it's a big crisis for the Great Plains. I own a little small ranch in Texas on the periphery of the southern Great Plains. So in a sense, I sympathize. This is my region in a way. Right now, the Great Plains has fewer people as a whole, depending on how you define it, than metropolitan Los Angeles. And the depopulation, part of it, you know, you could reverse with public policy, but part of it is simply that Americans are moving not so much to cities, but to suburbs in a few big metro areas. You know, there's what we call BOSWASH, the Boston-Washington Corridor on the East Coast. You know, there's the Central Texas Triangle. You know, there are various others. And it's a real struggle for a lot of small towns in particular to keep their people from moving. It's not to the downtown inner cities or the big cities in the classic sense, but to these big kind of suburban blobs that are neither rural nor urban.
It's always a shock to look at a nighttime satellite view of the continental United States, and you see these big, bright lights streaming down the East Coast and a few other places, Southern California, Central California, and the rest of it is just like little stars, maybe of the second magnitude, so much.
Well, I know Midwesterners and Southwesterners like myself, you know, always thought that the trend has to be things moving from east to west, and the east will fade away and the west will grow. If you look at those maps, it's clear that with the exception of this little strip along the Pacific coast, most of the population is east of the Mississippi River, which is where the water is, among other things. And most of the growth right now is taking place in the south on this arc from Austin, Texas and Dallas-Fort Worth all the way up through the Carolinas. So it's difficult to see how that trend will be reversed. The big shift is from north to south, east of the Mississippi, and you have this long-term trend of depopulation in many of the Great Plains states.
Now, in Kansas City, we're quite familiar with the notion of it not moving downtown, although it's much to be wished for by several interests here, but the growth of the suburbs, which even the suburbs that were brand spanking new in the 1970s are now looking a little bit used and a little bit deserted as people keep marching ever outward. And I don't think Kansas City is unique in that regard.
Well, I think that's going to continue. You know, my views on this go against the conventional wisdom that there's going to be this great downtown urban renaissance with coffee bars and nightlife and all of that. But if you look at the trends, after every census, America becomes more suburban and exurban, and I'm sure the 2020 census will show that, as the 2010 census did. And I think there are two technologies that will lead to even greater dispersal and even more far-flung suburbs and exurbs. One is telecommuting, something that more and more professionals are doing. It's kind of a class thing. If you're working class, you're not allowed to telecommute as much as the boss is. But the boss can phone in, do a lot of work from home. But eventually, as a cost-saving measure, I think you're going to see a lot of things outsourced by telecommuting. And that will allow people to live much further from downtown in cheaper areas. And the other one, which is closer than you might think, is robot cars, automated vehicles, both cars and buses and taxis. Google has logged several hundred thousand miles already with completely robotic cars, testing on California roads and highways. And the state of Nevada has legalized robot driving now. So if you have robot cars, that means that people can disperse much further because you can do a lot of work while you're in the car. It's a strange form of ambulatory telecommuting, if you wanted to use a fancy term.
I think
the suburbs are destined to spread. And if we have years and years of very low growth, then a lot of Americans whose wages are stagnant or falling are going to want to economize on housing costs, and that means moving further out.
So vast changes to come and vast changes in our past. Kansas City, if you want to join the conversation, ask Michael Lynn a question, make a point. Call us at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Or email us at updatedate@kcur.org. Brian writes on Facebook that the most important part of U.S. economic history was collective bargaining in the 19th and 20th century. Curtis on Facebook feels the Great Depression and FDR were some of the most important events and shapers of economic history in the United States. I presume you wouldn't disagree with those, Michael.
No, not at all. Collective bargaining was not very significant before the New Deal in World War II, and it really piggybacked on the federal government's orders for labor and business to get along in World War II, and in the private sector, unionization began declining. So now it's less than 10%. It's somewhat higher than that in the public sector, where there's a very well-organized political campaign to wipe it out. So I wouldn't exaggerate the role of collective bargaining, but it was very important in the 1950s and 1960s to raise the wages of industrial workers, and as well as workers in other fields who'd been very poorly paid before that time.
And that the Great Depression and FDR were one of the most important events. Yep, that was the start of your Third Republic that we're still sort of in now.
Yeah, and it remains to be seen whether the Great Recession, which is really a global depression, we call it a recession, but it's a kind of a contained depression, whether this has the kind of transformative impacts on the U.S. and other societies that the Great Depression did on, and in addition to World War II, on societies in North America and Europe and East Asia. I suspect it will. I think we're only in the early stages of the political turmoil that's going to result from the Great Recession and its aftermath. We keep hoping that it will be over any moment, but something on this scale, it can take decades to recover, as we see in the case of Japan. And as society changes and as technology evolves, the question arises, is there anything to go back to? What would recovery look like? Because we're not going to go back to this credit card-fueled boom economy of the 1980s through the early 2000s. So I think the world and the United States will look quite different in the 2020s and 2030s than they do now. And people need to start thinking outside of the box instead of having this rather sterile debate between going back to, you know, mid-century democratic liberalism, of which I'm a great fan, but it's not terribly relevant now in a lot of its institutions.
Huh.
On the other hand, just saying if we cut taxes and liberate markets, everything will work.
You're listening to Central Standard Friday on KCUR. I'm Monroe Dodd. And let's go now to Nick in Parkville. Good morning, Nick.
Good morning. I want to commend your speaker for trying to link history and politics to economic development. Clearly, they're well connected. I wish to comment on his comment that was related to another speaker's position that the U.S. has progressed because we've had low wages and unlimited resources. The wages bit. I think rather than being low wages, we've had a rational wage policy. We have not paid more than we need to shift people from one industry to another, and we have not paid so little that consumption has suffered. It's rational wage policy, I would submit, that helps a country to develop or not. I'd like to hear your speaker's response to that.
Well, My problem with talking about a rational wage policy is that labor markets are somewhat artificial. For example, if you have immigration restrictions, that's going to create one kind of labor market. If you have vast numbers of immigrants, you know, coming in and competing for jobs, you're going to have a different kind of labor market. The same is true of wages and hours laws and so on. So there is no natural free labor market. It's extremely contained and defined by government policy. And as far as consumption, what was called Fordism was widely embraced by both parties in the mid-20th century. It was the idea that workers should be paid enough to buy the products that they make or the services that they provide in the case of service workers. And it was named after Henry Ford, who paid his automobile workers high wages so that it was possible for a worker to buy a Model T. We've drifted away from that in recent years. If you look at the United States, both the Democrats and the Republicans favor subsidizing the wages of the so-called working poor through the Earned Income Tax Credit, which is now by far the biggest welfare program in the United States, although since it's done through the IRS, it's not as visible, but it is a massive welfare program. And I think this is very troubling because it means there's this ever-growing population of people, if they work 40 hours a week, 8 hours a day, they're still poor because their employers pay them such low wages that the taxpayers, you and I, have to be taxed to send these people subsidies so that they can pay their bills and eat. One of the things I think the president rightly did was to call for a higher minimum wage, and that is artificial, and it could cause some incremental or incidental unemployment at the edges, which has to be dealt with. But I think, you know, if we can't continue to subsidize employers so that they can pay a below poverty wage to workers, if you're going to have a business in the United States, then you should pay your workers, your poorest workers, enough that they can live and, you know, buy food and clothing in your area of the country, wherever it is. It may not be a single standard. If you work 40 hours a week, you should not be poor, and you should not be dependent on welfare, including the welfare that is in the form of wage subsidies like the EITC.
Nick in Parkville, thanks very much for your call. Michael, you throughout your book, you refer a lot to the actions of the nation state going all the way through this, the United States, the nation states, even in the future, China, Europe, United States. Is there a role in this country for all of our smaller forms of government, from cities to counties to states to nation states, in all of that or not?
Well, of course there is. And I think there should be a vigorous debate about federalism, because one of the things we've seen increasingly is that neither conservatives nor liberals seem to have any clear idea of what different levels of government should do. So you have liberals who want the federal government and the federal taxpayers to fund, you know, like local biking trails and so on through the highway bill. Now, why is a city biking trail, you know, something that should get federal funding as opposed to federal interstate highways, which are truly of national interest? At the same time, on the social level, many social conservatives have tried to regulate details of sex and reproduction and marriage through federal law. So I think it would be very useful. You know, my own bias is that the federal government should concentrate on doing a few big, simple things that it does well, which are chiefly defense. It's also social insurance, like Social Security and Medicare. It's more efficient to do that through one big, low-cost national program than it is through 50 little state programs, much, you know, less county-level, you know, city-level programs. But beyond that, we should delegate as much as possible from the states to the counties and from the counties to the cities. The advantage of that is that it allows more opportunities for individuals to take part in civic life and politics. You're much more likely to be involved in city council decisions than you are in the state house. And you're more likely to be able to influence your governor than you are your president.
Let's go now to Matt in Baldwin. Good morning, Matt. Baldwin City, I should say.
Well, good morning. And I wanted to say what an honor to be on with Michael Lind. I think, sir, you're one of the most perceptive writers on this subject. And I read with great interest your comparison of the of the Tea Party to effectively the Southern Confederacy, and I just wanted to put out there the idea about cultural forces that drive economics. I think we're much more subject in our present day culture to the force of Celtic tribalism coming through a. What I see in what are the Republican politics of now, and I trace it back. I try to think about what are the motivations for this, and I keep coming back to kind of Calvinist theology that seems to be coming through, and it seems to extend back well beyond the Whiskey Rebellion, but that seems to be a signature in the moment, or a moment in history that was a signature for what seems to drive politics today. And I wonder what you might think about that idea.
Well, thank you, first of all, for your flattering comments. I've written a great deal about this in other books, not just Land of Promise, about Southern political culture and how much it owes to the Scots-Irish. I'm half Scots-Irish Southerner myself. These were Scots who settled in Ulster, Northern Ireland, where they were used by the British to put down the local Irish Catholics in the 16th and 17th century. They then provided many of the frontiersmen and frontierswomen all the way from Appalachia to Texas. Both in the South and the North, many of these Scots-Irish settlers tended to be despised by the very wealthy, educated upper classes. They've disproportionately contributed to the army and also to prisons and violent crime. They've had few representatives in politics who tend to be in the Jefferson-Jackson tradition. Andrew Jackson, obviously, coming from the Scots-Irish tradition. The reason I think it's important to talk about it is there are distinct elements of Southern conservatism, which is very influential right now on the national level, that owe a lot to this kind of Scots-Irish folk culture, including the strong support for the military, the intense localism, the suspicion, and then the populism. And by the way, the Scots-Irish tradition has sometimes been on the left. Sometimes it's on the right. Sometimes it's on the left. It tends to be populist and Jeffersonian. It's not discussed that much in politics, but I think it's been very influential. And when the Scots-Irish of the South, it's mostly the Highland South, the Ozarks and the Appalachians, when they were in the Democratic Party, they were a very powerful force now. Now that the South has become the base of the Republican Party, ironically, because the former Confederacy now is the most Republican part of the Union, and when Lincoln was the first Republican president. You can't really understand Southern politics without understanding Scots-Irish folk culture. And that was a big a battle in border states, including Kansas and Illinois and Indiana, because a lot of the Southerners who migrated there were Scots-Irish, and they collided. They had quite different cultural and religious views than some of the New England Yankees who had traveled from upstate New York around the Great Lakes and into the upper Midwest. So, yeah, these cultural clashes are just as important as clashes between industries or economic classes.
Yeah, all my reading of the border wars is that the Missourians, who were oftentimes came from Kentucky or Tennessee, were quite resentful of these New Englanders, of the New England Immigrant Aid Society, who started places like Lawrence, and thought they were kind of snooty, in addition to feeling the wrong way about slavery. We may have somewhat of a related question here on Facebook. Jeannie asks, with many Great Plains states depopulating and with lost primary economies in agriculture, data show these states rely much more on social programs than the rest of the country. So I'm curious, Michael, what you think is the reason that there's such a devout voting for conservatives in those states?
Well, I had an uncle who was a rancher in Texas who got all of his medicine from the Veterans Administration. It was socialized medicine, and received farm subsidies and constantly denounced socialism. So there's a certain amount of what could be called false consciousness, I think, you know, that is like the sign that said, get your government hands off my Medicare.
Yeah.
You know, benefits, government benefits that go to you. Well, that's okay. Right.
Yeah.
I think with the Great Plains in particular, a lot of it was farm subsidies. And So some of those are somewhat misleading, you know, saying that people in Great Plains are just kind of welfare cheats and they're living off of welfare. I think if you factor the farm subsidies, I don't think it's that much more significant. And the thing that needs to be remembered about the farm subsidies is the Midwest always gets blamed for them and has certainly profited from subsidies for some crops. But if you look at the history of farm subsidies in the U.S., it was largely Southern. You know, it was rice and soybeans and sorghum and these Southern crops that these Southern Democrats who control Congress between Franklin Roosevelt and Tip O'Neill. So the Midwest kind of gets a black eye over what was largely a Southern farm subsidy program. Although there is ethanol, which that would be another program why I think that's both ecologically destructive and economically misguided.
Well, that's all the time we have for today's show. I wish there were more. Our guest has been Michael Lind of the New America Foundation, and we've been talking about the economic history of the United States, which he tells in compelling fashion in his book, Land of Promise, An Economic History of the United States. Michael, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Our show was produced by Matthew Long Middleton. Our announcer was Michael Byers. You can listen to this program again, subscribe to our podcast, or listen to any of our previous programs on KCUR.org. Up to Date is next with two Kansas City winners of the Guggenheim Fellowships and 90 Mile View. I'm Monroe Dodd. This is Central Standard Friday, and please enjoy your weekend.